Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. At one point or another, as children, we all experience a fall, but then we quickly bounce up, get back up, and continue playing. For seniors, however, a fall can be a life-endangering experience. As we age, balance declines, but exercise can help minimize the health risks associated with falling. Evan Papa is an associate professor of physical therapy and rehabilitation science at Tufts University. Evan, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So why does our sense of balance decline as we age?
Well, it's a natural function of aging. There's a lot of things that decline as we age. Vision declines, hearing declines, but muscle strength is an important aspect of balance. Coordination is an important aspect of balance. And neurologic systems, like the way that we sense and feel the earth underneath our feet, that declines as we age. And so it's just a natural function of life on the earth.
Gravity is a thing, isn't it? Right.
It's a thing.
So gravity hits you a little harder the older you get. And when you, and you know, kids, they fall down all the time and bounce right back up. But why can't older adults bounce right back up?
Well, because there's so many different changes that occur as we age, there's a natural process called sarcopenia, which is an inevitable process of the muscle declining, the actual proteins in the muscle. There's fewer of those as we age. That even can start as early as 40 in our fourth decade, in the 40s. So I've started to experience some of that. Mm-hmm. And we need to intervene in different ways to offset that. I don't want people to think that it's inevitable that you will have a fall, that you are destined to be injured because of muscle weakness or changes in vision or balance. We can offset that with exercise, with healthy living standards, patterns like sleep and rest and proper nutrition, et cetera. So
does gender make a difference? Does one gender fall more than another?
I don't think we have enough data on that right now to say that women fall more than men or men fall to women. I think it's pretty equal across the board.
And what about lifestyle factors? Do active people fall more or fall less?
That's a really good question. I don't know exactly what the data would say in terms of a relative risk of falling for active people versus less people. But I can tell you from my clinical experience that active people fall less than people who are sedentary.
I guess it would be hard to study because, you know, do you fall more because you're out there moving more, or, you know, if you sit most of the time, you have less risk of falling. But then when you do fall, it hurts more, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's one thing that we know for sure relative to exercise is that regardless of your age, you can strengthen your muscle. You can improve your balance. You can improve your efficiency of neurologic function to your brain and your coordination. We've done studies in mice to show that even older age mice, if they start exercising, if they're sedentary for most of their life and they start exercising in the latter half of their life, they still have improvements in motor function. So what I would suggest people do is don't be too concerned. Oh, I'm in my 70s. I'm just going to fall. I'm destined to have a fall. That's absolutely not the case. You can improve in strength and function.
So what other physical conditions in older adults contribute to falls? I'm talking about things like arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned, talk about the idea of vision changes and what that does to depth perception. What happens there?
Yeah. So I'm certainly not an ophthalmologist or an optometrist. Mm-hmm. I'm a physical therapist. But what we know is that as we age, our ability to perceive things either close up or far away will be reduced. And vision is one of the three main functions of our balance. So balance is composed of vision, your somatosensation, how you feel the earth, and then your coordination. And so if any one of those things declines, your ability to control your balance will decline as well.
Now, in my life, my mother lost some hearing in one of her ears, and that has impacted her balance. She, as soon as she lost the hearing, she immediately was, you know, tripping more often. What does hearing have to do with it?
It's not so much the hearing, it's the inner ear function called vestibular function. That is a very important element. One of those three important elements of function is called vestibular function. And vestibular function works in that when it senses how much your body is moving in space. And it can be tricky because, you know, if you're sitting in a bus and a car goes past you, you feel like you're moving, even though the bus is not moving. Mm. That's what your vestibular function is supposed to. It's supposed to tell you that you're not moving. Your eyes will tell you you're not moving, but your inner ear will tell you that you aren't moving. It'll give you the sense that you're moving, even though it's from something else. So a decline in any one of those functions, vestibular, visual, or somatosensory, will decline your balance.
And you also mentioned that medication can cause dizziness or drops in blood pressure. What are some medications people take that can lead to being more perceptible to falls?
Yeah, I don't want to get into a full list of prescriptions of medications. People should probably talk to their doctor about that.
Yeah.
But in general, there are prescription medications like sedatives or blood pressure medications that can reduce your blood pressure, which, as one example, what we call postural hypotension or orthostatic hypotension, when somebody goes from a seated position or a lying position to then immediately standing up, if your blood pressure, if you're on medications that reduces the amount of, thins out your blood and reduces the amount of blood that you have to distribute through the system, then that can decrease your blood pressure when you go to stand up and you can immediately pass out or feel dizzy. And so people should talk to their doctor about that.
Right, but you need to stay on some of those medications to deal with other health issues. So
100%, which is why I don't want to make any recommendations that you should change that. You've got to talk to your doctor about that.
Right. If you're more aware, you know, like taking this medication helps me in XYZ area, but it does make me a little more prone to falling. Can you be more aware and be more careful in the way you move about the world?
Yes. You can. Awareness is one important element, as well as exercise. Exercise improves the flow of your blood through your body, whether that's strength training. Strength training in particular is one method to improve your blood flow, but cardiovascular training, so walking, is a great exercise for older adults to improve the efficacy with which your heart pumps blood, the efficiency by which the blood flows through your arteries and veins. Those are mechanisms that we strongly encourage people to participate in throughout their life.
This is Wellness Wednesday, and I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking with an associate professor of physical therapy and rehabilitation science at Tufts University, Evan Papa, and we're discussing what it means to take a fall at an older age and what we can do to prevent the risk of falling. So can you tell us about the difference between our chronological age and our biological age?
Yeah, this is a great new area of research that's being conducted around the country, around the world. Is essentially your chronological age is basically how long you've been on the earth. The date that you were born till now, that's your chronological age. And you have no control over that. That's just basically who you are. It's in your genes. But biological age is a new phenomenon we've been studying recently. And it's essentially a function of your physiologic makeup. The cells within you can actually be younger than your chronological age. If you're active and exercising, if you're eating healthy, if you're getting enough rest, and if you're properly stressing the body, there's a term that we call that's called hormesis, which is a really important method, way of thinking about how we stress the body. And if we place enough small stress on our body, it's actually healthy for our body. So exercise is a form of hormesis. Fasting is a form of hormesis, just applying small stresses to our body so that it allows the body to adapt and to change. And your cells, your muscle cells, your heart cells, your bone cells, they can be strengthened through small amounts of stress that are applied over time. And so I always encourage my patients to really focus on your biological age, less so than your chronological age, because you have no control over when you were born, but you do have control over how much you sleep, how your proper nutrition, your exercise, et cetera.
How do we figure out our biological age? Is there a
test? There's a blood test.
There's a blood test. Oh.
There's a blood test. Yep, you can go to your doctor and ask for a blood test. A functional medicine doctor, or those that really specialize in this.
Is that a standard thing, or is it something special you do have to ask for?
You have to ask for it. It's not super standard, but a functional medicine doctor will know exactly what you're talking about.
So you've mentioned a couple of times how exercise can minimize the health risks of falling. And talk more about how it's never too late to start exercising. So even if you are 70, 75, being more active will help, right?
I mentioned that study we did earlier about, with the mice. And I always tell patients that my patients said doing something is better than doing nothing. And so you don't have to, start this amazing, huge, massive exercise program. It's too complicated. It's really difficult. Start with a simple walk, right? Start with a walk and do that every day. If you're in your 70s or 80s or 90s, it doesn't matter. You can start with something that can get you moving, and that little bit of mobility will give you confidence. It will give you, you'll start to feel better. Your body, your mind, your heart will start to feel better, and you can progress from step by step. People have often heard that adage, how do you eat an elephant? You do it one bite at a time. And exercise and lifestyle modification is the exact same way. We can't do one big, huge thing. It's got to be small things consistently over time.
And are some exercises better than others? What about something like yoga or Tai Chi?
I get asked that question a lot, and I tell people, do what works for you. There is no evidence that says that one exercise program is the best, the 100% cure all. Any exercise is effective. So if you like yoga, and I love yoga, it's great for the body and the mind. There are definite studies that show that yoga improves your balance. If you like having a partner, then walking is great because you can walk and talk with somebody as you're going on a 20-minute, 30-minute, up to an hour. But again, start small. Start with what works for you. I always recommend strength training. People often kind of push that one under the rug, but particularly as we age, as I mentioned before, this term called sarcopenia, our muscle mass reduces automatically. It's going to happen, but that can be offset with strength training. And if you're going to overcome a fall, you've got to have sufficient strength to get that leg out in front of you, out in front of your center of mass to push you back up against gravity, as we talked about before. So lifting a small amount of weights, using some bands, you don't have to go out there and be, Arnold Schwarzenegger pushing these massive amounts of weights. It's just a little bit every day, every couple of days. Allow your body time to rest. But any form, we call this multimodal exercise, lot doing lots of different things is beneficial.
And people who have really severe balance issues, sometimes it's recommended they use a cane or even a walker, but there is some stigma about these devices. Some people just don't want to be seen with a cane. What would you say to them if it's going to help them not fall?
I'm sensitive to that as a physical therapist. Obviously, we work with a lot of patients who need assistive devices. For the loved ones, for the caregivers that are out there, I would speak to them first and say, really work hard to encourage your loved one to use a cane or a walker if needed. Sometimes we have to make that decision for them, which is always a really difficult decision. For individuals who feel like your balance is declining, just try it. Try something simple in the beginning. A single point cane is often a good starting point, and then you can progress up there to a 4-point cane or to a walker or other devices as needed. But there are clear studies that show that people who have balance issues have fewer falls when they are using an assistive device.
Well, thank you for your time and thank you for talking about, but I get the bottom line, exercise, no matter your age, just even if it's just a little bit, get start exercising to reduce the risk of falling.
You got it.
All right. Thank you so much to Evan Papa, an associate professor of physical therapy and rehabilitation science at Tufts University. Thank you, Evan, for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Amy.
And more to come on Wellness Wednesday. This is Wellness Wednesday on all sides. I'm Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. One in four Americans are diagnosed as obese. As a result, they are at higher risk of serious disease. In the past two decades, children have become more obese, and they're developing obesity at a younger age. If something is not done, these obese adolescents can become obese adults with serious health problems. Dr. Christine Wen is a pediatric gastroenterologist and a multimedia journalist, and she's currently focusing her reporting on pediatric obesity. And Dr. Christine Wen, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
And why has obesity in children increased over the past two decades? Why are we seeing that now?
I think it's multifactorial, and a lot of times we don't know all the answers. We do know that that there have been a lot of lifestyle changes over the past several decades. There have been a change in dietary patterns in the United States, a change in physical activity. There's also been, I think we don't know about, there's some issues that people brought up with the food system, our microbiome. We're really studying that. But what we do know is that definitely since the 90s, we've seen a marked rise in pediatric obesity specifically, and the rise is really going up really quickly, and that's been the concern.
Some children just naturally carry extra weight, what we used to call baby fat or something like that, but sometimes they grow out of it. How is that different from actual being diagnosed with obesity?
So obesity, I think a lot of people think of obesity as a physical appearance. As a physician, I like to think of it as a diagnosis, like it's a disease, a medical condition. And so I think there's a lot of terms get thrown around a lot, like overweight and obesity, and they're all considered sort of interchangeable. But in a medical terminology, obesity is a specific diagnosis, specifically a child with a body mass index over the 95th percentile. And, not all children with a high BMI are unhealthy. That's absolutely true. But what we're seeing is an epidemic within an epidemic, meaning that there are more children that have a BMI above the 99th percentile. And that's when you get to that point, the chances of some health risk, health harm increases dramatically.
So how is obesity measured in children? You mentioned the BMI. Is that the standard?
So right. We don't have a good way. Obesity has a medical definition. The World Health Organization calls obesity abnormal or excessive fat accumulation that presents a risk to health. It's a health factor. It's not a description of someone's appearance. A body mass index has become like a proxy. It was never invented to diagnose obesity, but It's what we have because we don't have, most offices don't have the kind of machinery it would take to measure body fat in every single person. So it's unfortunately a quick way to take a child or a person's weight in comparison to their height and measuring it against a standardized norm. And it's a screen, and it's also a tool for physicians to use to track weight over time.
Now, I have two elementary age students myself, and when you look at a class of even kindergartners, they are all different sizes, right? I mean, the kids grow so rapidly. I mean, some kids grow two clothing sizes in 1 year. You can't just look at a child and say that child is overweight, right?
No, you don't. So clinicians will do is we'll take a look at the BMI and then also look at the other factors in the child's health, in the child's health. Are they able to it's hard with obesity with children, but, you know, are they able to keep up with their peers in exercise? Are they having evidence of hypertension? We see hypertension in kids very young now. Do they have other factors? Are they showing signs of prediabetes? So we don't just take a look at that BMI. It's a screen, and it's an imperfect screen, but it's sort of like an alarm to say, okay, now that we see this, let's look for some other things.
And it's developing in a younger age. I mean, how young are we talking that you use the word obesity with a child?
Well, with the current AAP guidelines, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they're saying that, you know, clinicians should be screening for obesity starting at 2 years of age. That seems really young to a lot of people, right? They say consider screening from 2 to 5 years old, and then above that, you should be screening. It does appear very young. But the reasons behind that is we know that children a lot of times don't grow out of obesity, and that's why they're advocating that kind of screening early.
What health complications are associated with obesity in children? Do they differ from adults?
Oh, boy. So children have a lot of different health complications for obesity. Some of them include the ones that we worry about right now a lot are what I see a lot of, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It's called fatty liver. Other conditions include diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes, which is highly associated with carrying excess weight. Other issues include cardiovascular problems occurring early, occurring early on, changes in children's blood vessels, changes in their structure of heart. Cardiovascular disease starts in childhood. Obesity also affects the incidence of asthma, breathing problems such as obstructive sleep apnea, musculoskeletal problems. Children can develop early forms of arthritis, menstrual irregularities are also associated with obesity. So there's a slew of health complications associated with obesity.
And you're seeing more of these, right? Like type 2 diabetes is being diagnosed more often in children than ever before.
So I'm not a pediatric endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist, but mm-hmm. what we do see is a lot of these conditions occur together. Mm-hmm. And it's associated with something we call the metabolic syndrome. Someone with diabetes is more likely to have hyperlipidemia. That means high triglycerides or high cholesterol. They're also more likely to have fatty liver, also more likely to have high blood pressure. So they tend to occur together. And what I'm seeing in my clinical practice is that the children may be seeing me for fatty liver, but they may also have prediabetes, or they may already be on medications for high blood pressure.
So as a doctor, what recommendations do you make to parents in order to treat weight issues?
I think when we talk about weight with children and parents, we have to be very mindful. The medical establishment is guilty of, promoting a lot of weight stigma. In our society, people get judged a lot on the weight. I think when we speak to families, we need to be talking about health and not the weight.
We need to not talk about the number, like the number on the scale.
Right.
Does that that doesn't matter as much as if you're healthy.
Right. Right. We're not, I don't think we should be advocating for a skinny society. We need to be advocating for a healthy society. And so I don't talk about the absolute number, but I'll say things like your weight might be putting you at risk for, this health concern. When we talk to kids, some kids are really motivated by being healthy and some kids are not.
Why?
They're like, whatever. So, when you talk about kids, maybe motivate them a different way. Hey, if you eat more fruits and vegetables and you don't eat all this sugary stuff, you're going to feel better and you're going to perform better in your soccer game. You might have better focus and you might, if you like gaming, you might be able to, beat your friends at this game because you've got faster reflexes. So you have to sort of tailor the talk a little bit.
So you're wanting weight loss in children, but you don't want to praise weight loss. So how do you do that a different way?
Yeah. Well, the research has shown that praising weight loss or weight gain in any way is usually counterproductive. And we all know that eating disorders are on the rise. And when you praise a child for weight loss, you sort of create this cycle of reward for this behavior. And if they don't, if they gain it back, that can also cause problems. I think when you talk about weight, it's really important to talk about the health. You know, these kids don't have to get skinny. They just have to eat healthier. They have to get more physical exercise. They need to sleep more, and they need to spend less time on screens.
So this is a whole family. You recommend a whole family change. So it's healthy choices for the whole family. So it doesn't seem like you're, it can't be a punishment for one child. Like everyone gets dessert except you, right?
Right. And unfortunately, Amy, sometimes in the clinical setting, that's what I see, and it's so heartbreaking to see. Sometimes a child will come in and they're already upset because they're like, "Oh boy, this is the talk that everyone's gonna be yelling at me about my weight." And sometimes families, you know, they get disappointed when they see the child hasn't lost a lot of weight, and you hear, you know, like, "Well, you can't have this next then," and you know, we can't have you know, and sometimes you know. Families can focus on the child and still continue the rest of the family doing whatever behaviors that were promoting obesity in the child. And that's, you know, that's just stigmatizing the child. That's just punishing the child. Any change that has to be made has to be made for the whole family. And unfortunately, I've heard people say, okay, next time we're going to go to X fast food place, you're not going to get to have something. I've heard that so many times, and it's
but the whole family should not go to X fast food place. The whole family right. should go to different, healthier yeah. choice fast food place,
right.
which there are more
right.
of. There are more of now,
right? And we don't need to. I mean, we don't need to have something that's very, you know. I always advocate small incremental changes. You can't be advocating, okay, now we're going to eat nothing but fruits and vegetables or things like that. But, you know, even if you, you know, because of how your family schedule is or, you know, what money is available for food, you can choose the more healthy of not so healthy options and discussing families, okay, now if we have to go here, what are the healthy choices that are here? And just thinking about that as a family.
We are talking about childhood obesity, and joining me on Wellness Wednesday is Dr. Christine Wen, a pediatric gastroenterologist and a multimedia journalist. So is the issue of childhood obesity being given the attention it deserves, you know, just around the country in general?
Well, part of the reason why I did this, participated in this health equity reporting fellowship is what I'm seeing is a lot of times the media covers what's hot. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really cover always what's important. I mean, every day I hear something about Ozempic or, you know, I hear something, you know, even, you know, things like bariatric surgery. Most people are not on Ozempic. Most people are not having bariatric surgery. That's not accessible to a lot of families. And that's not, you know, so I think what we're not talking about is sort of what happens day to day. We're not talking about, even when we interview experts, sometimes these experts, they have a lot of resources, and in some communities, they don't have those same kind of resources that those experts talk about. And we want to be realistic about what's available to everyone in different communities.
So we're not going to talk about weight, the number. We need to avoid talking about it as a diet. We need to talk about it as a being healthy. But you said earlier that a lot of children just don't respond to that word healthy. What are some other words or other ways we can talk about it?
Talking about feeling good. What I've seen in my clinical practice is, you know, if I see the kids with fatty liver, these kids with fatty liver don't necessarily have to lose a lot of weight. They basically have to improve their condition. A lot of them just have to stop consuming things that have the added high fructose corn syrup. And you see remarkable improvement in their disease. And so what I've seen is when those kids remove those items from their diet, they feel great. And they never knew how bad they felt. So it's a sort of, you know, and so, you know, just like you know, talking to kids about, you'll feel better, you'll have more energy, you'll be able to, you know, you won't be sleepy all the time. Things like that are important to talk about for kids, and not necessarily about you're going to be healthy, because in our country, healthy, we kind of associate healthy with a certain appearance or something like that. And that's just not, that's not a good message.
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about that appearance and the body image problems? If you are hearing everyone around you talking about body image issues, it's hard for a child. I mean, there are just some children who are just bigger than other children, right? But they are, if they're still healthy, then it's okay. We need to stop talking about our bodies so much, right?
Right. I think, unfortunately, body image sort of kind of tracks along all different age groups. And a lot of families, they talk about appearance, because, maybe the parents have some, are concerned about their appearance as well. And we need to be very mindful when we talk to children about, our appearance, our weight, because they're always listening. Mm-hmm. A child who is carrying extra weight may not be unhealthy, but what we're focusing on as clinicians is that there are a subset of kids that are definitely unhealthy. And what we're seeing is a dramatic increase in pediatric diabetes. Pediatric fatty liver is now the number one chronic liver disease in children in the United States. Research shows that because of some of these adverse health effects, this current generation of children is going to have actually a shorter lifespan than their parents because of all the combined health risks. So we need to talk about health. We need to talk less about appearance.
There's a body positivity movement going on. Is it? Do you think it's just not reaching everyone enough?
Well, I practice in a very specific area, and I see mostly a low income population, people of color, and I think that sometimes still their voices aren't being heard. I think in some populations, people's bodies are different, but what we're not addressing is a lot of those children are experiencing health effects. And so I've been listening to some of these body positivity talks, and I'm not sure always we address those children. Hmm.
It's what can we do to address those children? What do we need to see more diversity in what areas?
I think we need to understand that, I'm reporting on sort of underserved and underreported communities. And I think still in a lot of reporting, we tend to focus on very urban communities or more, or people who are more willing and more trusting of the media to speak up. Yeah. And I think in general, we're still not hearing from a lot of people.
And we mentioned at the beginning that over the past two decades is when we've seen this like growing, increasing amount of childhood obesity. And I can't help but think that the number of screens in our lives have increased in the past two decades. Is that a big part of the problem? Too much time on screens?
Well, we know, for instance, that before the pandemic, about 19% of children were overweight. And after the pandemic, over 22% were. Now, it doesn't sound like much, a 3% change, mm-hmm. but that's a lot more kids. And that was a time when kids were at home. Maybe they were learning on screens. Definitely every parent will know that their child's use of screen time increased dramatically during the pandemic. And, there was also less access to the physical activity and other things too. Kids weren't going to school, but I think that, normal childhood play is different now than it was in previous decades.
So parents need to make a more concerted effort to make sure their child is in an activity that is not screen-based.
Right. And it's tough, right? Because
but that's what they like. That's what they like the most. Yeah.
And we're also seeing the professionalization of childhood sports. You know, a lot of times you feel like if your child isn't in soccer by about three, they're not going to be any good. And then they're not going to play soccer. And then for the kid who's not the athlete, what kind of physical activity is there? What I see is like for most part, kids stay pretty active through elementary school. Mm-hmm. But then once they enter middle school or high school, if they're not already in a sport,
then they're not good enough for that sport. Yeah, they feel like they're not good enough for that sport. There's there's no junior league in some of these soccer places. Yeah.
No. And so I think we as a society, maybe one of the solutions is to look at ways to increase physical activity for the huge subset of kids that aren't, athletes of some, almost professional caliber.
All right. Well, this has been Wellness Wednesday, and we've been talking about childhood obesity. And Dr. Christine Wen, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Amy. Thanks for this conversation.
Dr. Christine Wen is a pediatric gastroenterologist and a multimedia journalist. And we have more to come on Wellness Wednesday. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Now at Ohio State, a new podcast featuring researchers, innovators, and bold thinkers who look at our world, see what the real challenges are, and create the solutions that people need now. Available on your favorite podcast platform or visit go.osu.edu/now.
From an Iraq war cover-up to towns ravaged by opioids to the roots of our modern immigration crisis, Embedded explores what's been sealed off and undisclosed. NPR's original investigative podcast reveals why these stories and the people behind them matter. Listen to the Embedded podcast, only from NPR.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Whether you make it at home or grab it at Starbucks, Dunkin', or Tim Hortons, or someplace else, many people begin their day with a cup of coffee. But your cup of coffee could be at risk of extinction. Here to tell us why is Thomas Merritt, a professor of chemistry and biochemistry. Thomas Merritt, welcome back to All Sides.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, when the producer of All Sides, the senior producer Marcus Charleston, told me that coffee was at risk of extinction, I immediately thought, "Oh no, what now?" So tell us about this fungus that is placing coffee at risk.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, and coffee is great for headlines. It's one of those things that jumps up, and many of us see these and we thought, "Oh goodness," right? Oftentimes those headlines are a bit inflammatory, but coffee really isn't in jeopardy. So there's a fungus called coffee leaf rust, or CLR, that's moving through coffee plantations and destroying commercial coffee production. Historically, this has happened. So you've heard of Ceylon or Ceylon tea. Ceylon is now currently Sri Lanka. At one point, it was one of the world leaders, top three in coffee production. There's no commercial coffee production in Sri Lanka. Or at least very limited. It's not a global player. And it's because of that coffee leaf rust. It moved through Java. We often refer to coffee as a cup of Java. There's no commercial production of coffee in Java because of coffee leaf rust. So the pathogen moves in, it spreads from plant to plant, tree to tree, and then it can be moved from plantation to plantation. And it basically will slowly but effectively destroy commercial coffee production. It has moved into the New World. And so since the 1970s, it's been found in South America and Central America, and it's slowly moving through those as well. So there's a real chance that coffee, at least the coffee that we have in our cup, at least the cup in front of me, Arabica, could be in jeopardy and could be gone by the end of, say, within my lifetime.
Is it unusual that I consider myself a avid coffee drinker and a fairly curious person. I had never heard of this fungus before. Is it not well known?
That's an interesting question. I don't actually know the answer to that other than it's out there. Mm-hmm. There was a really great article in The Atlantic sometime in the last 2 years about what this could mean. It's potentially one of those head in the sand things. You know, we're comfortable not knowing things that make us uncomfortable. And this is something
Stay around Googling what's going extinct next that I need to worry about.
and so, you know, the chances of coffee going extinct, at least the beverage, the idea of this beverage that something like 80% of the world, at least 80% of North America, starts their day with a cup of coffee. It's likely that coffee won't go extinct. It's entirely possible that Arabica, which is the coffee that we're drinking right now, could be commercially extinct in our lifetime. And those are two different points. So I was chatting with Marcus earlier. People often sort of roll their eyes at this kind of news, like, okay, that's interesting, but it's not going to happen. But I don't know. Do you eat bananas? So I go through waves where I'm a banana guy and I'm not a banana guy. But you know, many people start their day with a banana. The banana that we're eating now is not the banana that our grandparents ate. So we eat a banana now called the Cavendish. And in the early 1900s, the banana was the Gros Michel. And by all accounts, the Cavendish is a terrible banana. And we don't know that because the Gros Michel is commercially extinct. And it's commercially extinct because a fungus moved through and wiped out commercial production of that variety of banana. So, you know, will there be coffee in 50 years? Yeah. Will it be Arabica? We don't know. And some of it's going to be how we handle the Arabica that we're growing now and how we handle coffee production just in general.
So is it true that this fungus that we're talking about is responsible for why the British favor tea over coffee?
Yeah. So there is a serious historical argument that that is in fact the case, that with the collapse of coffee production in parts of the British Empire, the Great Britain, they switched over to tea because they could grow tea in areas they couldn't grow coffee. So Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, their economy recovered, but it recovered in a different way. Java, I think the leading industry in Java right now is tourism. It's not coffee.
So the impact that this, what impact is this fungus having on coffee producing countries right now where it is found? What's happening to their economies?
So, you know, the coffee economy is enormous. We're talking about the economy that drives something like 125 million people are involved with coffee production. And there are 25 million small coffee farms in the world. All of them are very conscious of the fact that the way that we're growing coffee has to change. So we're seeing moving of coffee. There's a Aaron Davis is a scientist at the Royal Botanical Gardens who's written about this idea of what's going to happen to coffee. And the term that he uses is future-proofing coffee. So how do we future-proof coffee? And there are three things that we can do. We can change where we're growing coffee. So coffee grows better and can resist the rust better at cooler, wetter climates. The planet is getting warmer with global warming. That shift is changing where we can grow things. And so one of the things that we can do to future-proof coffee is we can move coffee growing to higher elevations. But you're going to run out of up. Up only goes so far, right? And that's why there are areas that we can no longer grow coffee. We can also change how we're growing coffee. And so we can do things with irrigation. We can do things with shade growing. Shade grown coffee has been a big thing since I started drinking coffee in the 90s. But the way that you grow coffee can make the coffee more resistant and at least slow the spread of the coffee leaf rust. The other thing we can do is change the kind of coffee that we grow. And I've written about this in the past. What may end up driving acceptance of genetically modified organisms, GMOs, might be coffee. So we can actually modify coffee to be more disease resistant. We can also just grow coffees that are more disease resistant or more drought resistant. So Robusta is the other major player in coffee production. About 40% of the world's coffee is Robusta. And Robusta is resistant at least to the strain of CLR that's out there now. So what may happen through time is we start drinking more Robusta. The problem is Robusta sort of terrible. It's the coffee that gets turned into instant coffee and maybe some decaf coffees. So there's a real push to find a better Robusta. And there's actually a world of now Robusta specialty coffee because Robusta can be grown in places that either we can't grow Arabica now or that we may not be able to grow Arabica in the next 5 or 10 years.
Why haven't scientists been able to find a way over all these years to stop the fungus?
You know, disease progression in crops is an arms race. I think that we're better at stopping the fungus now than we were 20 years ago. But as we get better at fighting the fungus is evolving, and it's able to sort of slip around the defenses that we're creating. One of the issues is that Arabica is slow growing. You know, we're talking about a plant that you're putting decades, investing decades of time into a coffee tree that's actually productive. So breeding or selecting for resistant Arabica takes a long period of time. And so it's not that we're not trying to fight CLR, it's a losing battle. And eventually we're going to have to come up with some different strategies.
Can you slow down the fungus? Have they figured out how to do that? Maybe if you see it coming, can you build a wall?
Yeah, well, and so the answer to your first question is actually your second question. You know, we know that building walls doesn't work. Mm. Eventually, things always get around over or through walls. And so we have walls up there. A lot of the things that, you know, it's a fungus, so we can use fungicides. But you're now in this battle with how much pesticide, how much fungicide, how much chemicals can you treat an area with while you're still trying to produce a healthy beverage. There are some interesting lights on the tunnel, light at the end of the tunnel. That's the wrong analogy, isn't it? But there's some possibilities out there. And so Robusta and specialty Robusta is one. There's another commercial coffee called Liberica, that about 1-2% of coffee production in the world right now is Liberica. And but it seems to be resistant to CLR and more drought resistant. And so we may be looking at Liberica in the future. And then there's a third coffee called Stenophylla, that essentially is a lost coffee. And I just think this is amazing. So Aaron Davis is one of the people who's discovered this or rediscovered it. So 100 and something years ago, Arabica wasn't necessarily the dominant player in coffee production. And there was this West African coffee that by historical accounts actually was a better cup of coffee than Arabica. And it's been rediscovered. It's CLR resistant and it's as drought resistant as Robusta. So what we may be looking at over the next couple of decades is a shift away from Arabica and into these other things like a specialty Robusta or Liberica or Stenophylla.
But you said it takes decades, so we need to get started on the Liberica now, right?
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case. So that's really, I think, one of the things that's happening is sort of a global push. There are two things. One is to start ramping up the amount of these other coffees that are being grown so that they can be commercially viable. And the other is to find things like Stenophylla. So it is still found in the wild, but in little tiny pockets. And so there's a real push to try to find before deforestation or climate change destroys these genetic reservoirs, or for example, a CLR resistant Arabica. So, you know, there are resources out there that we're trying to take advantage of before we lose them.
Did I read in your piece that there are some snails out there that eat this fungus?
This is another lovely story. And so When Aaron Davis talks about future-proofing coffee, one of the things that he says is we can change the way that we're growing coffee. So monocultures are bad, and monocultures are susceptible to disease, they're susceptible to drought, they're susceptible to a number of different things. One of the unexpected benefits of growing coffee in a complex environment is there are snails that eat CLR. And so there's a really fun study that took snails and took coffee leaf rust and basically found the leaf rust in the poo of the snails. And there's only one way to get into poo, and it's through the other end. And so these snails are actually selectively eating the fungus off of these leaves. And so there's a thought that this is far from commercial production, but there's a thought that we could use things like a diverse ecosystem to actually create a healthier coffee environment. And so my comment was, you know, a pairing of escargot and espresso. But it's really not that far off. These snails actually are an example of how a complex environment is a healthier environment.
Now, snails are notoriously slow creatures, right? So I'm not seeing deploying snails doesn't seem like a practical, fast solution.
No, and that's actually one of the points that the authors make is, in general, you don't want to introduce organisms that are not already in an environment. And this is how we get invasive species. This is where the gypsy moth came from. This is where a number of species that are really devastating in parts of the world have come from our introduction. But what the authors are arguing is not necessarily that this one particular snail, but that snails, slugs, other mollusks in general, and really just complex ecosystems can help us fight things like the coffee leaf rust. So not that we're going to bring something else in, but we're going to create and maintain a healthier environment, a more diverse environment.
Is there anything that I can do as a coffee consumer to help the future of coffee? What can consumers do?
That's absolutely a really great way to address this. What can we do now? And one of the things that we can do now is support growers that are ethically and responsibly growing coffee. And so you see things like shade grown or bird friendly coffee. Those are really things that we can look for and help to support the farmers. That kind of growing tends to be more expensive. But if we vote with our pocketbooks, and we push things with our economy, if we're buying the coffee that's being grown in a sustainable fashion, we're more likely to have sustainable coffee.
All right. Well, we can hope for a better future of coffee, or at least we'll get used to drinking a different type of coffee, right? In the future.
That's both of those are a possibility.
And some of these major coffee plate like Starbucks might have to change which beans they pick, right? Them too.
I think that's a really good point. And this is, we can vote with our pocketbooks and we can push for sustainable coffee. But until we get things like Starbucks and Folgers and Maxwell House, they're really big economic players, coffee is going to be in jeopardy.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and making me worried about my morning cup of coffee. We'll see what happens over the next few years. Thank you to Thomas Merritt, a professor of chemistry and biochemistry at Laurentia University in Ontario. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us today, listeners. Thank you. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.